Good morning. Good morning, church. Happy Resurrection Sunday. Yes. Hey, I wondered if we could begin our time with a little thought imaginative experience. And here's what I want us to think about. I want us to imagine that you had the ability to talk one-on-one with a Powerball lottery winner. But here's the interesting twist on that. That this person that you're about to talk to literally had the Powerball winning numbers. They had the winning ticket, but they did not collect the money that was associated with that winning ticket. All of us would be very curious about that. And so we get into the conversation. We say, hi, my name is, you say your name, and they introduce themselves, and you say, hey, I heard that you had the winning numbers and the winning ticket for the Powerball lottery. And they say, yeah, I did. And you're curious, right? Because you heard a rumor that they never collected the money. So you're trying to figure out how to get to that little point there in the conversation. You say, could you tell me about that? That must have been thrilling. And they say, yes, it was the most thrilling thing I've ever experienced. And you say, go on, do tell. And they say, well, I was watching the TV. And they started to like list off the Powerball numbers one by one. And then the first number came up and I was like, well, that's my number. Wow. And then the second number came up on the TV and I'm like, that's my number. And then the third came up and then the fourth and the fifth. And I'm like, at this point, I'm like on the edge of my seat, my jaws dropped. And I'm like, what is happening here? And then finally, the last number is ready to pop up. And they're looking at their number, looking at the screen, looking at their ticket, looking at the screen, and then their number pops up. And then this person you're talking to says, I just went ballistic. I jumped out of my seat. I started screaming like a school-aged child. I was losing my marbles because I was so excited. And they say, I've never been that thrilled in my life. And you're like, wow. This seems to be legit. This person literally did have the winning numbers in the Powerball lottery that happened. And then, here's your next question. So what was it like when you went to collect the money that was associated with that winning ticket? And they say this. Oh, I never went to collect on the money. Maybe a misunderstanding. Maybe that sometimes you get into a conversation, you're like, you're missing each other, and you're like, no, like you knew you had the winning ticket. Oh yeah, I had it. I clearly saw it. So exciting. I'm gonna ask it a little more directly. Did you ever take your ticket to the lottery people and say, I won? Where's my money? And the person says, no. And you're like, why not? Why did you not do that? And their response is, well, because having the winning numbers was so thrilling that I thought, I don't need anything else. I'm good. You're like, what? You thought that was good for you? Like, yeah, that was good. I mean, I was competing against millions of people, and I won. I was the only one that got the numbers. I was so excited. I'm like, I'm good. And you're like, no, you're not. There's something wrong. How many of us know that having the winning numbers for a lottery ticket is not the end of your lottery adventure? It's the beginning of your lottery adventure. And I say it's the beginning because, what most of us know is that what you should do, yeah, be excited you got the numbers. Thrilling. I would imagine that'd be awesome. Now! It's just the starting point. Go take your ticket to the lottery people. Say, can I please have my money? Receive the money. And now you have the adventure of spending, hopefully, if you're wise, maybe the rest of your life doing amazing things in the world with that newfound wealth. The winning ticket is not the end of your adventure. No. It is the beginning of your adventure. Yes or yes? Okay, we're all in agreement there that person would be out of their mind for treating the winning ticket as the end of their lottery story instead of the launch into or the beginning of their lottery story. As absurd as that illustration is, I wonder if we do the same thing with Easter, resurrection morning, that person that we just described did with their winning lottery ticket. I wonder if, if we see Easter Sunday as the end and not the beginning. And I get it. I understand how we could do that because for years I did that. Because when you think about it, we were just here on Good Friday and we worshiped and honored Jesus for going to the cross. And now it's Easter morning and we're here to honor Jesus for bursting up out of death itself into resurrection life. And in that, we know, if you've been around church like ever or at all, you know that because of what Jesus did, we have now been given the opportunity to receive forgiveness because of what Jesus did. We have the opportunity to receive his washing, his pardon, and his redemption. All of those things are done. And so it might be easy to think that Jesus' work on earth is finished. All of these things are done. Okay, check that box. Now, for the rest of my life, I guess with that being finished, I can just go on and do my thing, live my life, figure things out. And it makes sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but I see how we can get there. That we would see Sunday, Easter morning, resurrection as the end instead of seeing it as the beginning. When you read the Gospels, all the Gospel writers write about the death of Jesus and the resurrection at the end of the Gospel story. It's at the end. When Jesus finally gives up his life on the cross, he says, literally quoting Jesus, "It is finished." And so maybe many of us are lulled into believing that the resurrection is the end of Jesus' work on earth. But what the scriptures teach is the complete opposite. That resurrection Sunday is actually the beginning of God's work on earth and in us. And that's what I want us to talk about this morning. So, what is God building on earth? Where Good Friday, the cross, and Easter Sunday, resurrection, were necessary. If that's the beginning, then what in the world is the rest of the story? If winning the lottery ticket is the beginning and spending the money is the rest of the story, what's the rest of the story regarding what Jesus is doing on the earth? Ephesians chapter 2, verse 19. You thought you were going to get away from Ephesians on Easter Sunday, didn't you? Here we are. This is what we talked about last week. "So then you," Paul says, "you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God." Hint, God is building a house. Verse 20, "And this house is built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom," in Jesus, "the whole structure is being joined together." That's not past tense, friends. That's not yesterday. Being is a present tense, ongoing into the future. In Jesus, the whole house structure is being joined together, and it grows into a holy temple in the Lord. The word "grows" there is not past tense. It's not growed. It is grows, present tense, ongoing. Jesus is building his house, which is his temple. It's the place where he dwells. Then he continues in verse 22, "In him," in Jesus, "you also," you, like believers in Ephesus, and this is us too, "you also are being built." That's not past tense either. "Are being built" is present tense, ongoing. "You also are being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit. The work that Jesus came to earth to do is this. This is what he wanted to do. This is what he longed to do. This was his destination, to build for himself a dwelling place where he could abide on earth, and the dwelling place was people. That's the work he came to do. Now, Good Friday and Resurrection Sunday were preliminary works that he needed to do to set the stage for him to be able to do the work that he really wanted to do, and that is make us his house. Easter is not the end of the story. It is simply the beginning. But before Jesus could get to building his house, his dwelling place in us, there is some work that he needed to do first to establish the open door for him to build on earth. I'm curious here. I want to see how many of us are already here. How many of us have read the Chronicles of Narnia or maybe seen the movies? Okay, many of us. If those names don't ring a bell, just know that the Chronicles of Narnia was written by C.S. Lewis, Oxford professor of literature, follower of Jesus, loved the Lord, and he wrote Narnia as like a parable or an allegory of this, what God is doing and has done and is continuing to do in the world. Because sometimes it's helpful to just like step out of here and like look in a different direction, learn some lessons, and then apply them back here. Lewis was brilliant. And so in Narnia, C.S. Lewis created this whole new world. And in this whole new world, you're not going to find Jesus, who is the great king over all things, but you're going to find Aslan. Aslan is the lion who is the Jesus type in Narnia. What Jesus is to us, Aslan the lion is in Narnia. And there's this scene where Edmund, this character, this young boy, has committed a betrayal. He violates what C.S. Lewis calls the deep magic that is embedded in Narnia. And so because Edmund commits this wrong, he now has become a slave to the White Witch. And what Aslan would love to do is to set Edmund free from the clutches of the White Witch. But Aslan can't just stroll into the White Witch's castle, tear the place up, grab Edmund, and get out. Aslan would love to do that, but he can't. And Lewis describes why. It's because of the deep magic that exists in Narnia. Now, if magic is weird for you, sometimes like as modern people are like, I don't know what that means, that's kooky. Let's change deep magic to deep law. There is a deep law that God, who is the creator of Narnia, embedded into the creational structure of Narnia itself, so that when someone violates the good and right laws of Narnia, they become a slave in the property of the one who is on the other side, the dark side. And so Aslan knows that he can't just go set Edmund free, but he must honor the deep law that is embedded in Narnia in order to set Edmund free. And so what Aslan, the lion, has to do is to offer himself up as a sacrifice, a substitute, to take the punishment that Edmund deserved so that Edmund can then go free. Aslan goes down, Edmund goes free. Beautiful picture. C.S. Lewis got it, right? And Aslan knew that that's the only hope that Edmund had of ever going free. And Lewis says this in the Narnia context because what Lewis wants us to know is that our world has also been created with an embedded deep law that God himself chooses and must honor because he's the creator of the law that he embedded in this world. You're like, what is the deep law? What does that mean? Here's an example. When God made creation itself, he formed and fashioned the earth, he put human beings on earth, and he gave us something that we call free will. God gave us agency, the ability to choose and to make our way and to make decisions that really matter and they're really coming from us. That's a gift that God gave us, and it's embedded in the creational and human fabric of all things. And so here's what that means. because God honors the deep law that he establishes here on earth. And so here's a practical example of what that means for us. When a human being does something tragic, horrific, ugly, or nasty, what we tend to do is we say, God, why? Why would you allow this? How could you let this happen here? And C.S. Lewis would say, no, you're missing something here. That God himself has created things here. He's given humans this gift, and there is a deep law enacted here where God allows that to play out. He will not just run in and suspend the deep law of human free will. He must let it play out. And so it's not God's fault that crazy bad things happen here. It's us. And it's the person that did it. The deep law is in effect, not just in Narnia. Thank you, C.S. Lewis. But Lewis says that so that we would understand that there's a deep law that is enacted here that God himself chooses to honor because he's the one who made it all. So now with that in mind, I want us to go to Matthew chapter 4. And I want us to see a story unfolding that only makes sense when you understand the deep law that God has created and fashioned this world with, that he honors. Matthew chapter 4, this is before Jesus begins his ministry. He's about ready to launch. And he goes out into the wilderness, and the accuser, the Satan, it's a Hebrew word, Satan, the adversary, comes and meets Jesus in the wilderness just at his weakest point. And he begins to tempt Jesus. And here's one of the temptations, and it is fascinating. Matthew chapter 4, verse 8, right? Again, the devil took Jesus to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and all their glory. And Satan said to him, all these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. Satan offers Jesus the ability to take over the reins of the world now. Jesus, instead of doing all the things you think you got to do and saying all the things you think you got to say and going to the cross and the resurrection, hold that, I've got a different way. You can take the reins of ruling the earth now. And Satan literally has the ability to offer that to Jesus. What? Why? Because of the deep law. Because of the deep magic that God honors. Let's back up a bit. Genesis chapter 2. God creates everything. He makes mankind. Adam and Eve. He says, Adam and Eve, you and your kind who will come from you, I designate thee as the rulers over all of creation. You are in charge. And you ever seen like somebody become a knight where the king's like knighting them with the sword on their shoulder, like whatever that ceremony is where like you weren't a knight, now you're a knight? God knights Adam and Eve as the dominion holders of all creation. You are the authorities here, God declares. And it's a beautiful arrangement that God puts in place because here's what God wanted it to look like. That as Adam and Eve and their offspring would rule over creation, that they would do it in the way that God designed, that they would do it in partnership and in relationship with him. And that all the things that God made us to do, to organize and plan and execute and do art and do music and build buildings and build culture and society and find new ways of cooking food, that human beings would do all of that as the rulers of creation, and they would do it in partnership and in relationship with God. And it is an amazing story that he wanted to write with people for the duration of time. What an incredible thing that God invited us into. But then we learn in Genesis chapter 3, it didn't take long. Watch out, free will. Watch out, human agency. Watch out. Sometimes we'll go in some places that we ought not. That's exactly what Adam and Eve do. Instead of living their lives submitted to their loving and kind creator, who is also their father, and living life with him, what they chose to do is to submit themselves to the deceiver, who said, hey, I think I got a better way forward for you over here. And so Adam and Eve exit their relationship, partnership with God. They submit themselves. They bow the knee to the serpent. And in so doing, because of the deep magic, because of the deep law embedded in this world, Satan becomes the legal authority over planet Earth. Or as Paul would say in Ephesians, that he is the prince of the power of the air. Because he was. So mankind enters into an agreement with the serpent. Instead of walking with God in peace and in joy and in love, they follow the serpent into brokenness, frustration, and division. And God had already declared in advance what would happen if they chose this route. What would happen is that instead of living a life of hitting the target of like awesome, beautiful, joy-filled life, that's like hitting the target, that they would instead live a life of sin. Sin means to miss the target, right? That's what happens when you choose out of God into the serpent's way. And so sin is embedded now in the fiber of the world. It floods in. And God had already been clear. When sin floods in, the next thing that happens is separation happens. What do you mean separation happens? Well, you literally start coming apart in your very self. You become divided, distracted. You start coming apart at the seams because you start to become separated as a whole, integrated human being into something that splinters out into far less. Separation happens in each of us. And then what happens after sin is that separation creeps out of us into all the relationships that God made us for. And our relationships start separating. Genesis chapter 3, it isn't like too long after the first bite that Adam and Eve are fighting with each other and need some marriage counseling. Why? Because they're separating. And so all our relationships start getting pulled apart and ripped apart. And then one of them, like the main relationship we were made for, is us and God, who made us and loves us. And that relationship separates. Why? Because God wants it to? No, because of the deep magic and the deep law that we chose out of that. We walk in sin, everything starts separating, and we come apart in our relationship with him. Our relationship with God is broken and fragmented. And then after sin sets in, separation and always sets in, and then God was very clear in the beginning that death is the result of all of that. Not good. What God wants to be alive now becomes cursed with death. So sin, separation, and death became the new normal after Genesis chapter 3, because there's a new sheriff in town. And he's got a whole different program that he's operating on planet Earth. And so in Matthew chapter 4, when Satan shows up, he is offering Jesus what he had the legal authority to offer to Jesus. Jesus, you can take over right now. And if Jesus chose to say yes, Satan, I agree to your terms. I will take over now. Thank you. Let's shake on that. Then here's what would have happened. Jesus would have had the ability in that seat of authority to soften the blow of sin and death, but never to remove the blow of sin and death. If Jesus accepted Satan's offer to rule now on his terms that he's offering now, Jesus' work on earth would have been limited to legislating people from the outside. He never could have moved into our hearts to actually transform us. Jesus would have been like a governor or a president or a municipal judge or a police officer who is managing our behavior from the outside as the authority, but never able to get deep in us, which is the place where he always longed to get to do his building work there. Or to put it like this, Jesus would never be able to transform our hearts. He would only be able to manage our actions. So what Jesus could do, if he says yes in Matthew 4, is Jesus could end divorce now. He could legally say, you will never get a divorce because I, Jesus, am in charge, and we never would have gotten any more divorces. Okay, but what Jesus couldn't have ever done in that scenario is actually help married people love each other. If Jesus says yes, he could legislate and mandate and ensure that we no longer kill each other. But he never could have moved into the space of our hearts to actually transform us, to give us peace, so that instead of just not killing each other, we actually love and walk in harmonious relationship with each other. He never could have done that. What Satan knows is that Jesus needs a permit to build in this world. And Satan is offering Jesus a permit. This summer, my family, we're planning on doing a Great Western vacation over a number of weeks. We might be crazy for thinking that. 7 people, 1 minivan. Either it's going to be epic or it's going to be horrific. I don't know. Sometimes you got to roll the dice just to do the thing. But imagine that we find ourselves in Montana. I hope we get to Montana. Big sky, right? Come on. Let's say we're in Montana and my kids, some of the younger ones say, Dad, I've never seen anything like this. This is amazing. I love it here in Montana. Dad, we need to build a cottage for our family right here. And that is an absolutely beautiful sentiment from one of my younger children. Yeah, we need to establish a cottage here where the Kunkler family can come back and enjoy with a dwelling place the wonders of Montana. But here's what my kids wouldn't understand if they made that request. We all understand this. You can't just build your thing anywhere you want to build your thing. Because there's a deep law embedded in the land where this is somebody else's land. The first thing, son, we have to do is we have to buy the land. Somebody else owns it. We can't build on somebody else's land. We got to buy it. Even after we buy it, we got to go to the municipal authorities and talk to them and say, hey, what do your zoning rules and regulations allow us to build in this place? Could we build a cottage? How big does it need to be? Does it need to be, like, what kind of, all the things, all the zoning laws. We know that. You can't just build anywhere. You have to get a permit to build. What Satan is offering Jesus is what we'll call a very conditional permit. Jesus, you become the legislator of the world. You're in charge. You dictate behavior. You stop people from doing bad. You enforce them to do the good. And Jesus, to that offer of a very conditional permit, Jesus says, no, thank you. But he didn't say thank you. He just said no. No, I don't want that. Matthew 4:10, Jesus' response says, then Jesus said to him, I was totally wrong. Jesus' response is way better than mine. Jesus says, be gone. Be gone, Satan, you and your conditional permit. Get out of here. For it is written, for you shall worship the Lord your God and you shall serve him only. Get out of here. Jesus says no to Satan because Jesus wants so much more for his people than Satan is willing to permit Jesus to do in people. What does Jesus want to do? He wants to make people the place where he dwells. He doesn't want to legislate us from the outside and control us. He wants to move in and live life side by side in an abiding relationship with us, and Satan's permit won't allow him to do that. Jesus wants to position people to be his place. So what Jesus had to do is he had to go ahead and get an unconditional permit. And it would cost him everything to get that. Everything it would cost him to get the unconditional permit to move into our hearts in this space to honor the deep law. So here's what Jesus did. Where Adam, the human being in charge, gave Satan authority on earth through his disobedience. Jesus, fully human, God knows what he's doing. Jesus, fully human, gained authority on earth through his absolute and perfect obedience. He never sinned. He did it right. Where we all failed, Jesus nailed it. And so now Jesus is free to unconditionally build on earth, permit obtained, deep law satisfied. And where people were stuck in the debt of their sin, what Jesus did is he legally paid the debt by offering his perfect life as a debt payment for us on our behalf. Or as Paul has already said in Ephesians, we have been redeemed. What redeemed means is that your debt payment has been paid. It's legal terminology. This is deep magic kind of stuff. And how many of us know that there's a difference between renting a place and owning a place? When you rent, there's only so many things you can do. Don't put screws in the wall. Don't hang pictures there. You can't paint. Well, but when you own the place, it's yours. And so Jesus didn't just want to like pay the interest on our debt just to like rent us for a little bit. No, he paid the whole thing so that we would become purchased as his. So he would be free to build in all the ways he wants to build in us and among us. And then where people were cursed with death, which is the result of our sin and our separation. It's just the final end game of all the places that we go in the serpent's design. New operating system of the world. Death is the end. Where people were cursed with death, what Jesus does is he goes to the cross and he literally in himself absorbs the death that was due us and he takes it upon himself. The death that was due you and due me, Jesus says, let it be upon my shoulders. And it cost him everything. And then he literally dies. And he goes into a deep, dark, tragic place to take all of that upon himself. And then, that's not the end of the story. We gather here on Sunday morning to celebrate. Why? Because death wasn't the end of Jesus' story. He took our death upon himself, and then he carries it, he crushes it, and then he bursts up out of the grave into resurrection life. And that's not just for Jesus. He says, I've come up out of the tomb. Resurrection life is mine. And what does he want to do with that? Be stingy and hold it for himself? No, he did it because now he has it, and now he has obtained the permit in this world to freely distribute it to anyone that he wants to. And he wants to distribute it to everyone. And he says, just receive and believe. That's all you have to do. I did all the work. I pulled the permits. I gave my life. I paid the debt. I conquered death. I raised into resurrection life. I did it all. All you have to do is say yes. And when you say yes, it's not the end of the story. It is just the beginning. It is just the start of what he wants to build in you, in us, in the world. It is not past tense. It is present tense, and it is ongoing. And if Jesus gave everything to start building this work among us, I just wonder if we have such a small view of what we think God wants to do in our lives that we believe it's insignificant. The lengths to which Jesus went does not give the indication that the work that he wants to do in us and among us and through us, it doesn't indicate that it's insignificant. Oh, it's bigger and better, and it is more than any other ideas that we have for what our lives should be on planet Earth. The deep law fulfilled, Jesus finally ready to build. Jesus' resurrection is not the destination, it is the launching grounds. to celebrate Easter and not participate in the build that Jesus wants to build is like having a winning lottery ticket and never collecting on the winnings. It is absurdity. Worship team, come on back up. I'm going to close out with one more thing. Lest we think that what Jesus longs to build in us and among us is insignificant. In just a few verses in Ephesians chapter 3, teaser, Paul is going to say that the ongoing work that Jesus is doing in the world is so magnificent and so awesome. He says this, literally, we're going to get there. Teaser. He says, it is so amazing that the spiritual beings that live in the heavenly realms are so absolutely tuned in to what God is doing in us. Now that he has permission to get in and build all that he wants to build and to build all the things he wants to build through us, he says, the spiritual beings in the heavenly realms that we can't see, they are tuned in and they are locked in, watching magnificently. Unless you're on the dark side team, then horrifically, what God is building in the earth among us. Right? How many of us ever watched Chip and Joanna Gaines rehab a house? And you're sitting on the couch and you're like watching, you're like, whoa, they're gonna take out that wall. That's awesome. That was the right decision. I love that they're taking out that wall, right? You're gonna paint that color, Joanna. Great color scheme. I love it. Sitting back, like we watch home improvement renovation builds go on because we think that's awesome. In the same way, the spiritual beings in the heavenly places, they're not on the couch watching TV, they're among us. And they are watching like, God, what are you doing here? I see you moving and Ron right over here. And I think I know what you're doing because 2 weeks ago I saw you doing this. Wow, I think you're going to break through right now. I think you're going to do the thing. Like the spiritual beings are just locked in and they are magnificently and with wonder saying, Jesus, your build is awesome. I'm watching. I'm waiting. I'm with it. I'm tuned in. Stay tuned for next week. And they just keep locking in and they're watching and they're even participating. Some for good in participation with God, some for ill to thwart what God is doing. But the key is what God is doing is magnificent. So I want to end with this. Do not see the wonders of the cross and the wonders of the resurrection as the checkbox end of what Jesus is doing on earth. It is not the end. It is the beginning. And God will honor the deep law. He honors our agency and our decisions. He will not build against our will. So I don't know where you're at this morning in your engagement with the partnership relationship that God offers to build in you and among you and through you. But just know that what he wants to do is so much more than you ever thought. He's got so much more than you've ever dreamed, and all you have to do is say, yes, I believe I am in. And then the launch. Here we go. He is risen. And it was just the beginning. Father in heaven, thank you for loving us so well. Thank you that in the honoring of the deep law that you gave everything to obtain an unconditional permit to have full access to do all of the good work that you wanted to do in us and through us. And so, Father, to that, on this Easter Sunday, we celebrate Jesus as the risen, conquering King, and we say, yes, we want you to reign over us and to reign in us because you have the permitted ability to reign in us now. Would you come make your home in us, and would you bring to bear among us all the things that you want? We don't want the spiritual realities and principalities and dominions to be bored watching us. We want them to be on the edge of their seats because everything you do is an awesome nail biter. It's an intrigue. And it's a rowdy party. So we say yes. And we give you freedom to build among us because you've earned it. And now we worship you and sing to you because you're worth it in Jesus' name.